Good morning.
Good morning.
It's almost afternoon. I'd like to share with you a little bit about a method that's kind of evolved out of my work with refugees over the last 16 or 18 years. Currently, the work that I've been doing was with Burundian refugees, but I've worked with many, many cultural groups. And in that, developing what works and what doesn't work, a lot of you have experience with that because every group that you work with is very, very different than the last one, right? So I wanted to share with you this approach that's developed out of the work. Well, I may be relegated to this thing. Okay. So I want to share with you that I have no relationships at all. I'm just telling you. All right. So cognitive mapping, if you're unfamiliar with this process, it's not a process that we typically use in public health, but it's one that I've begun using because it's been very helpful to integrate psychology into the work that I'm doing. Many of you who work with refugees realize that many people who come into the country from war, refugee camps, are exposed to many traumatic events. And so to use psychological techniques is really quite logical. And I've moved into using those so that we can establish a baseline for how people perceive their environments, how they move through the world, and how they process information within the context of that world. This is just an example of a modification that I made with pictures using the cognitive processing within the Burundian group. I won't go into a lot of the information around the Burundian culture, mainly because this is a process that can be used with just about any group that you'd be working with, including Americans. Because as is mentioned in many of the other presentations, if we have multiple forms of interaction with people, not only is memory better, but they also process information so that we understand it much better. So, why did I use cognitive mapping? I was searching for a way to try and traverse our challenges that we have with language and culture. Many of the groups that I've worked with in the past have not translated information in the way that we do in America. And so that in its own right is a real challenging process to try and figure out how it is that we can come to the same operating ground. We can understand things in a very similar way because within their country they act and behave in a different way that is more socially constructed in their country, and then we do in our country as well. So we know that language and culture really do provide some barriers for us as we go into work, whether it's in research or in programmatic interventions. We have our literacy challenges, but literacy not just in the way of reading and writing, but also in the way of interacting and understanding health literacy, but also cultural literacy and understanding each other and navigating our environment. Trauma stories have become a real hurdle for what work that I do in behavioral research. And so this has been a way for me to traverse the trauma stories. Many of the groups that I've worked with have indicated that their trauma stories change over time because there are many factors that contribute to their trauma story in their countries as they're trying to come as refugees. Many, although they're not fabricating, they are sometimes exaggerating or changing or telling someone else's story because theirs is just too painful. And therefore, they don't connect with their trauma story until they start feeling more stable in their own, in this country, and finding some source of safety. And then their trauma stories actually start coming out, the truth of their trauma story. And you guys are shaking your head. I know you've experienced this, right? So then we look at the depression and trauma issue, because if we look psychologically at the the evolution of depression. Depression is actually protective for us. Depression in its own right helps us gather our resources internally so that we can push through and actually make it through the situations that we have to endure. And sometimes depression becomes dysfunctional because if we can't pull out of what has been termed as putting on hold or allowing the brain to update so that it can survive the situation, then sometimes we get stuck in that depressive hold. And so cognitive mapping is a way for people to tell their stories, pull themselves out of what depression has depressed, and then allow us to connect with them so that they can tell their stories in a way that is meaningful to them, but also more importantly meaningful to us as we're trying to reach out and connect. This has been a fun process. The refugees that I've worked with for the last 6 years have found that this is a way to connect in a very fun way, leveling the power differential between the actual researcher or program developer and the individual who is trying to get their stories across. And so that connection with the pictures makes it really, really fun for them, and they take control of the entire process. So they can control how much information that they're willing to dole out and how much they want to share with you as the facilitator. So when we first started this process, we wanted to know what we wanted to know, right? We basically wanted to know what were their personal resources, perceived or real, that they felt they needed in order to feel safe and secure in their environment. And so we wanted to know what's protective for this group of individuals versus what's harmful. Sometimes we as volunteers wanting to really help, sometimes we create harmful situations that we're not aware of because we are culturally very different. So that boils down to something as simple as chewing gum while you're doing an interview with someone that can be very, very offensive to some people. And so we have to know and have boundaries and context for what we're working with. So we want to know what they value. We also want to look at the client's perception about what is safety and what is stability. We have different perceptions of that. We haven't had war in this country for a number of years, and to try and understand the flight that they had been dealt in their country by losing everything and having to migrate to another country, we can't possibly connect with what their perceptions of safety and stability would be. So what is baseline for them? It's not our baseline. So cognitive mapping helps us understand what is their baseline. We also, and very importantly, want to connect with their cognitive functioning. Many people who have been injured in war, or they have migrated and the stress has been overwhelming, may have difficulty in processing information in the first place. How difficult that is when we're all required to measure outcomes. If a person cannot achieve the outcome in the first place, and we enter them into ESL and we're saying you're level 1, you're level 2, you're level 3, but my funding hinges on whether I can get people to level 3, then it's basically shooting yourself in the foot, because if this person doesn't have the capacity, then guess what? We need to give them different resources to build their capacity before we enter them into the system of learning and developing and growing. And so we have to know where people are coming from. So, we developed a question pool, and because of time, I won't go through all of these, but I do want you to know what our main research questions were. What are the central social, economic, cultural experiences, and personal resources that define pre-migration, migration, and post-migration? Same question, just looking at it in different phases of their process. And then we also wanted to know, to what degree do resources contribute to the predictive ability of stability in their family. So how will we know? This is where a lot of us are wondering, how do some people do well when they come into the U.S. and migrate and integrate well, and then some people never integrate well. Why? So this is hopefully answering some of those questions to know what are the key factors that are protective and harmful. And lastly, we want to know when people are placed in neighborhoods, what makes them feel safe and stable in those neighborhoods. So we developed questions to assist in getting some of this information out. These are some of the questions, and you can read through some of them, but what you'll notice is they are mainly questions drawing out what their perceptions of resources actually are. Their resources don't necessarily mean those things are resources, as we're working with. And so we look at various and sundry questions that pull those out, and we had mirrored questions for migration and post-migration as well. So looking at the cognitive mapping cards that came out, we used some baseline information. We had done focus groups in the early part of this process. It's a larger research project. Developed resource cards based on what we perceived their resources were. We pilot tested those, and then we revised them based on the Burundian input on whether or not they resonated with the cards, and then what other resources they felt that should be added to the card deck. We ended up with 96 resources. So in the interview process, we interviewed asking them to identify the important cards first, then the not important cards. We took away the important cards, then we moved through the process and asked them to rank them in the order of importance. And so each of them took the cards and they could lay down. Now the beauty of this process is with each and every card they laid down, they described all the detail and stories that we wanted to hear around this process. So they elaborated on the stories. You got the information that you needed, not just by the ranking of the cards, but the mapping where their brain was going and telling you the stories and resources that they needed to be healthy or stable in their environment. So then you map out the process, looking at, this is one of the participants. The doctor was very important, but what we hear are questions and descriptions and stories about the problems that they're having. That meant a resource wasn't met. Therefore, we could look at these and discover where there are gaps in service, where there are maladjustments in families, and we could move in and ask them, what would make this better for you? You notice down at the bottom, many of our Burundians came in feeling like there was a promise of 5 years support of education, and they didn't have to work at all. Where do you get that? Yeah. So we went back to try and figure out where this came from. We worked it back to UNHCR, and we asked them how they do their training. So we were actually able to give feedback to UNHCR, and then we were able to go back to the Burundians and say, we're very sorry that this was told to you, but let's talk through this process. And we were able to dispel beliefs around the five-year mark, and we were able to move them through to begin empowering themselves to actually realize they're going to have to work, and they're going to have to learn English, and they're going to have to do these things. But just the ability for them to tell their stories and their frustrations around this five-year promise, and then for us to go in and try and dispel this, actually helps them move into being willing to get a job at that point and do the things that they know they needed to do. So, talking about relevance, when refugees come, as you well know, the internal locus of control, their internal control, is pretty much obliterated. They rely on external resources initially because they have nothing left. They are in a culture they don't understand. They are in a community that doesn't speak the language that they speak. And so the relevance of identifying external issues that help them integrate is really important. Then we want to look at resources that are protective versus those that are harmful and helpful for integration into the community. And then taking cognitive mapping, it's fun, but it also demonstrates that we care about their culture and we want to move through this process with cultural relevance and give them an opportunity, particularly those who are suffering from stress and are unable to access that information. They do that through many of the cards that were developed for their benefit. And I'll leave this up here. Very much to all of our speakers. We have a few minutes before the session's officially over, so I'd invite all of you to ask questions of any of the speakers as you please. Yes, go ahead.
So turning to cognitive mapping for other communities, are there sources that already have examples of resource cards, or do you recommend that a community go through that process of developing their own resource cards?
Well, I would of course recommend that each community do their own because, just as you and I are very different, many of the refugees are very different as well. They come in collective groups that sometimes have similarities and some are very, very different. If you work with Burundians, you know, you have two ethnic communities that split out of the Burundian community, and their priorities may be very, very different.
Can I ask you just a quick follow-up? So when they identified your top five and then you tried to help them around it, was the thinking to develop to connect them with a resource for each of the five, or to choose one of the five to say, do you want to work on this? Let's help you, support you to work on this. How to prioritize?
Well, typically, and because the group that I was working with tended to be very collective in nature, we found that many of the same things emerged. So we began to develop opportunities for them to have bridges. And we found out, for instance, that we were not seeing their needs in the way of doctors and medical assistance. So we then partnered with another local community clinic that prioritized all of the refugees first. So then they called an appointment, they got them in a week so that we could increase accessibility for the refugees in that area. Because what was being perceived is that they didn't show up for their appointments. Well, when the appointment is 6 weeks out, no, they're not going to show up. They've either got a job, they've moved on, they have the resources, or not. They just do not. So that was, if we saw a dramatic concern, for instance, in mental health and cognitive ability, we had a behavioral health clinic that actually prioritized refugees after we developed that relationship.
They were able to get them in individually, so it would be a good advice. Any questions? I'll let you think about this for a minute. I have a question for Rafi about her presentation. I thought some of the things Glenn talked about were actually relevant and potentially helpful in some of the strategies we were talking about for addressing health disparities among the Southeast Asian refugees in Connecticut, and part of my question was what training opportunities are integrated into the program for looking at language barriers and communication strategies, not just cultural awareness and literacy, but also an understanding of language barriers and how they impact on care, but then also what strategies might exist for non-language-based or non-literacy-based programs like using teachers. For Rath.
So for Connecticut, recently, we just partnered up and the Connecticut Asian Pacific Commission just created an ISB card into multiple different languages. So we passed it out to the Asian clients that every time we do a training, we pass that out. And we also, when we have a community program, we pass it out to the community. So if they have some kind of appointment that they need an interpreter, they could just flash out the little pocket card and just show that they need an interpreter and this is the language that they speak. So both in their native language and also in English.
Any other questions?
You were talking about the use of computer visual education that you were doing with communities, and I'm wondering, is it any time that the use of that kind of technology was intimidating or off-putting for any of your low-literacy participants? Because that's something that we've run into. I work with several different refugee communities in Atlanta, but we've had to adapt many of our health education programs and use just the regular, you know, handheld things and charge just to make it more accessible for people who maybe have never even been to school.
So that was just when I did an education session, and we also printed out lemonade, and then we also used that one to find the answers. So we are using both the computer and the handout.
Okay. And with the handouts, is that something that they could take home on the way with them?
So at the end of the session, I keep them a brochure. And I also use the same method for the appointment. All their tests will be there, medication they are on, the month that I can check it off. So I try to make this easy as possible, so something they can look forward to when they come each time. So I did not mention that one, but that was also included in the
method. That's a great idea. Thank you.
And I have a follow up question to that. So if you did a show, we can talk a lot. But this one thing, probably I think about the on doing another follow-up just because the graduation will then go from 6 to 9 months.
So I only measure from initial and okay. But then, as you can see, that certain areas the patient did not do well. So then I emphasize each visit so that they can remember to come in if they were experiencing any symptoms. But I did not measure that. The patients at FDBA treatment, because of the science that they can experience, they have to follow up every month until they change their treatment.
Yes, I have a question for Kristen. You said in the beginning of the process you started with a needs assessment. Did the target of nutrition and diabetes come out of that needs assessment? Or was that something that you went in and asked like specific questions to the assessment about specific nutritional strategies and diet?
That's a good question. Because WIC came to us and it worked out because we had already done family planning and nutrition diet. Well, diabetes was definitely an issue and nutrition was in that. But we talked heavily with the food needs leadership in the community, and that's what they want to focus on. We happen to be interested, and they had all their nutrition information and resources with their partners that will provide us with a lot of resources to provide that education. So it's kind of all worked out.
I can echo that to Phoenix as well, because the food needs community leaders themselves put together.
It's not
a protocol. Since you based any of your 9 training models on any of the core competencies that Minnesota has set for community health workers?
Right.
basically as a trial mine. The refugees have been toward trial mine. Are initially not in that local.